This podcast is for informational purposes only and does not constitute legal, tax, investment, financial, or other advice. It is not intended to cause or induce breach of an existing agency agreement.
Hello?
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 This is the Vancouver Real Estate Podcast.
And welcome back to Vancouver Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Scalina.
And I'm your other host, Matt Scalina.
And Matt, I should say host, but also realtors with Oakwin Realty in downtown Vancouver. I'm so excited for today because we've got Jack Bernard on the program. He is the Vice President of Client Services at Rennie. Huge fan of Jack's. We've known him quite some time and we've never had him on the program. This is a first, but huge takeaways from today's conversation.
Huge takeaways. When you think about why we haven't had Jack on, there's like no reasonable explanation, except probably that he's too busy. Although it was just such a great conversation, so many takeaways. It makes me think that we've missed out on having him on for the last 8 years or 9 years or however long we've been doing this. But hopefully we can get him back because, man, some insight on some opportunities in the market, kind of a really reasoned analysis and just an all-around great conversation.
No, for sure. And we talk about a lot of things, right? We talk about the pre-sale market. We talk about the resale market. We talk about challenges in the development community. We talk about challenges in the province. We talk about, areas where he sees opportunity right now. You know, the question of should I buy or not is covered. And also a question from a listener about prices being too high. Jack gives a very reasoned response to that as well. So tons of interesting directions this conversation goes.
And the other thing is Jack was around in 2010 when Rennie took over the Olympic Village, the receivership, and sold a lot of brand new condos that had not been sold pre-sale at pretty impressive prices. And he talks about today as being a similar market in certain areas of Metro Vancouver, but we'll let Jack talk about the opportunity. It's an exciting one.
And before we get to that, Matt, of course, this podcast is sponsored by Scalina Real Estate, which is our team in Vancouver. And I think you have a Remains Nameless trivia question for me this week.
I do, Adam. This one is going in a little bit of a different direction, but I think you might get it. That is, if you read the New York Times.
I don't. So I occasionally listen to the Daily.
The New York Times had an article April 2nd. So you were a couple of weeks off. The question this week is, a record store in Vancouver was featured in the New York Times. It's Neptune Records, which you're, of course, familiar with on Main Street. They had a reel-to-reel audition tape that was sitting behind the counter that was only recently discovered as the original from 1962. Adam,
1962.
What band's audition tape surfaced in a Vancouver record shop, which is now known to be Neptune Records, very recently?
Jeez, this is a really tough one, honestly.
Before we get to that, Adam, why don't we talk about one of our listings over at Scalina Real Estate, but also, of course, at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
Yeah, Matt, this week we've got a great listing that we're talking about. It's over in Kitsilano. I love this pocket. It's the Arbutus Walk area. Concrete building, 2001, built by Bastion Development. Really fantastic. So this is on Cranberry Drive, which is right by Arbutus and 12th. So unit 210, 2655 Cranberry Drive. Rarely available. This floor plan is super unique. It kind of jets out where you're kind of hanging over top of this picturesque, beautiful park, which is really nice. So you feel very connected to the park, which is across the street. and you're surrounded by trees. So now that we're hitting spring, those trees are starting to fill in. You've got this really beautiful, lush green exposure. Overhead ceilings, tons of windows, 2-bed, 2-bath, and over 1,000 square feet, 1,039 square feet. This is a fantastic unit. You can check it out. And it is listed at 1329900. So 1329900 over at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com, where you can see all of our listings.
Yeah, that's right. Head over to VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com to check it out. And while you're there, click sell with us. Of course, if you click sell with us, you can download the sold plan. That's our most downloaded PDF we've ever produced. The feedback is terrific on the sold plan. And of course, it stands for start on launch date. And it is basically a step-by-step guide to get your property sold as quickly as possible and for top dollar. And it's worked countless times, Adam. And that's at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
Yeah, Matt. And to answer your question, I'm thinking 1962, big news. I'm guessing it's got to be one of the big groups. Stones, possibly. Trying to think. You know, I'm going to go just because I've been listening to a lot of the Beatles lately. I'm going to go with the Beatles. And mostly because my daughter's getting in. This is, I don't think I've told you this, but there's a show called The Beat Bugs, which I think every parent should know about. But it's a cartoon where, I don't know the premise of it. I'm not going to go too deep here, but it's all Beatles songs. They just, they put like 2 or 3 Beatles songs into every episode. So now my 5-year-old has, she's got like, she knows like 30 or 40 Beatles songs. Like even some pretty rare Beatles songs. So it's pretty cool. It's between that and Taylor Swift, we've got enough music to go for years in the car. So I'm going to go with the Beatles.
You are correct. It was the Beatles' 1962 audition for Decca Records, an audition in which they did not get the record deal. And it was apparently sitting in Neptune Records. You probably stopped by and saw it, unbeknownst to you, for years collecting dust before they just figured out that it was an original. Quote by Paul McCartney about this audition. Listening to the tapes, I can understand why we failed the Decca audition. We weren't that good.
What? Did more before he was about 23 than most people do in their life. But here's the thing. What did it actually sell for? Or did it sell?
I don't think it sold. No, they just discovered it, I think last month. And it was like a couple guys sitting around, put it on, started listening. I think at first they thought, according to the article, that it might be a copy, but then there was some telltale signs that it was original. The quality, the sound quality is amazing. I think, and I'm going from memory here, there's 10 tracks on there maybe, and 7 of them are covers, only 3 originals. So anyway, it will be worth a pretty penny, I would imagine.
Interesting. Well, Matt, without further ado, why don't we cut to this conversation with Jack Bernard?
Enjoy.
This podcast is sponsored by Marcon, a local family-owned and managed real estate development and construction company that's been around for nearly 4 decades. Marcon is not only committed to high-quality construction, but it is also making a positive impact in the communities in which it builds, all across the Lower Mainland.
Adam, we want to highlight 2 incredible Marcon projects. Soane House, one of Marcon's latest communities that features a West Coast aesthetic with a more nuanced, Nordic-inspired design for architecture that endures.
Soane House offers 165 junior 1-3-bedroom homes in West Coquitlam, integrating nature into the built environment.
Register today at marcon.ca/soanehouse. That's marcon.ca/soenehaus. Or visit the display center at Outpost in Port Moody.
We also want to highlight 102 and Park. With billions already invested in Surrey City's central development over the last 15 years, the time is now to invest in its future, Surrey 3.0.
Introducing 102 and Park, a simple, straightforward skyscraper featuring 376 homes. Quite simply, this is a once-in-a-decade opportunity coming soon to Surrey's central downtown plaza. This is a time and the place to invest. Register at marcon.ca/102andpark. That's marcon.ca/102andpark.
Marcon, building for life. Okay, so we're here with Jack Bernard. He's Vice President of Client Services at Rennie. How you doing, Jack?
Doing great. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, Jack, you know what? I think we've known each other for about 15 years, but this is your first time on the show. Super excited to have you on. Can you maybe tell our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, I'm happy. Well, thanks for having me on. I love your show. So it's nice to be invited. I got my 15-year ribbon with our friendship, and you finally brought me on. But I didn't have much to say before now. I guess that was program. So I've been in real estate for, gosh, what's going on, about 17 years. I've been with Rennie for 16 of those years. When I first got licensed, I was just trying to figure out what real estate was all about. I made the jump over to Rennie when I left the hospitality industry job because I liked the program of working with developers and the stability of some project work. That's kind of the driver of why I chose Rennie. And, you know, I started off at 30 years old as a $12 an hour elevator host, taking people from the ground floor to the fourth floor at the Olympic Village. And that was my real introduction to Rennie and projects. And I've done everything from that through sales director, you know, up to now vice president with the Rennie Group, in terms of working with our clients, understanding their needs, and then helping them achieve the success just to get homes built. I think at the end of the day, that's what we're trying to help everybody do, and get the word out on what new communities are coming together.
Nice. Maybe as a launch off point here, Jack, how's the market?
Anyone listening to this, I think, understands that real estate in Vancouver is trying to. The market is tough right now. You know, I think globally, all markets are tough. We're watching the stock market really take a ride right now, and other things with tariffs and wild policy changes and what have you. And real estate's certainly taken a slowdown. And I think what we see, though, is that traffic is still happening at open houses. I think our presentation centers see healthy traffic, certainly a little bit of a reduction in traffic, but healthy traffic of people that are actually asking the right questions. They're just uncertain. You know, is this the right time? Are we at the kind of the bottom, which is kind of a fantasy, I think. You never really find that bottom, but people are just starting to figure it out again and see, like, am I safe? And I think what they like about real estate is that it's a tangible asset that regardless of kind of what happens globally, people are going to need housing, and they're looking to enhance their position, whether they're moving from a one bedroom to a two bedroom, if they're buying for the first time, or if they're looking to downsize, or simply just, you know, move into a different location that suits their life better. Those people are out there and they're asking the right questions. So the transactions are down, absolutely. The interest in real estate is always healthy in Vancouver. So we're having lots of conversation and just being prepared for when people feel confident and stable. That's really where it's at.
Can you talk a little bit about, because I know, you know, you're involved with the Rennie analysis, or the Rennie intelligence, I should say, and you guys are on top of trends and do kind of year end and year beginning. Can you talk a little bit about where you thought 2025 was going and how the last couple months have or have not thrown a wrench into the gears?
For sure. I'll clarify that I work with the Rennie Intel team, but the Ryans who you've met and I think have had on the show, and Roman and everybody that works over there are brilliant. I certainly love getting involved because they help us create kind of any sort of advice that we're giving to our clients. You know, 2025, you know, when we saw towards the end of 2024 and what I saw in the early part of 2025 was a couple month over month increases in sales for what we saw. We actually started seeing a bit of a sales drive through November, December. January, people were coming back into the market, really ready to jump. And a lot of that had to do with interest rate decreases, brought more people's buying power back. But there was some confidence, you know, that we were seeing some things level out. There was a number of projects that saw great success on the pre-sale side. Listings were still increasing, but not at the same pace. So there was this overall feeling amongst our realtors here at Rennie that glut of supply was not going to be around for as long. And then I can almost track it back to around February 18th, February 19th, February 20th. I remember because I had just given a presentation mid-February to a client that said, like, we're experiencing month-over-month increases in sales, and we should have some confidence moving towards a fall launch that they were looking at. And I said, currently to date, February is also looking like it's going to trend as the fourth month of increase of sales. Right around the time that Trump decided to tariff everything, you could see the sales just, it stopped. It, you know, it didn't go to zero, but it turned February into the first month in a long while that we saw that decrease in sales. So I thought at the beginning of the year that we would see a little bit of stabilization. By no means did I think we were going to get back to just incredible sellers markets of multiple bids or sellout projects. But I certainly felt this health and desire for housing coming back into the market, really from end users. So people that were going to live in the property, not the investors. They're still a little bit cautious with where rates are and where policy change happens. But this, the fear of potentially losing jobs or going into depression over what's happening outside of our control down south has made people stop or slow down or take pause. So as things continue to unfold on a globally, that health, that conversation is still there. So I have hope for 2025 that we will see it return to a balanced market, which most people in the real estate business prefer, right? There's not a frenzy of selling or a reduction, sorry, of buying. There's just like a healthy cadence of if it's the right home for you and it's priced appropriately, it moves. And I do have confidence that we'll get back there. I just think it is all subject to a few calming messages coming out of our own federal election at the end of April and maybe Trump focusing somewhere else, like islands full of penguins and not focusing on Canada so much. Right? But we'll see. We'll see. He's a bit unpredictable.
Yeah, so it sounds to me like, so, and I mean, this has kind of been our take as well, but it sounds like the market was kind of naturally picking up and the tariff was kind of the wet blanket. Or the tariff conversations around were what really kind of stalled things out. And that's kind of where we are now. So it sounds like this last week, and I mean, obviously the stock market has been a bit of a roller coaster the last week or so. We should timestamp this. It's April 7th at 11:20, which actually matters now because you have to be really specific when something changes every 30 minutes. So has this influenced Rennie, like Rennie as a company's strategy at all this year, just the last few months or few weeks?
I think anybody that says it's not impacted them is underinformed or not being totally transparent. So, yeah, I mean, yes, as a business operations, we're looking at a number of different things. We'd love to continue to grow from an office perspective, but we're just looking very carefully on, you know, what positions do we need to add, if any, at the moment. So in terms of like overall growth locally here, I think we're just taking a pause and making sure, you know, are our people in office overworked, underworked? Like, where do we have capacity? Where can we do, as opposed to just continuing to bring on talent that can help us kind of lead the growth of the company? When we look at the advice that we're giving to folks, you know, we're having to lean in a lot more with our developer clients, more specifically, and our realtors with their individual clients on the data that we always have kind of underpinned all of our commentary on. You know, so not rushing somebody to launch if they don't need to, you know, if their land holding cost is cash flow and they have the ability to continue to tweak and relook at what we've done from a planning perspective. Is it still appropriate for current market? What are the pricing elements of the project that will get things to move? You know, Grosvenor Brentwood Block is a project I had the awesome experience of working on. It's did many people at Rennie over the past number of years. And, you know, kudos to them as each time we got closer to launch, we continued to reevaluate if it was the right offering for the market. When we did finally bring it to market in September, which at the time was still quite challenged from a market perspective, you know, we saw a huge number of sales, you know, well over 100 deals sold in the first kind of 30 to 60 days. We continue to write deals every single week, which has been amazing for us. And, you know, we've just started under construction at the end of March, getting the project going while continuing to write deals. And you know, I attribute that one in specifically to the amount of gut checks, relooking, ensuring it's the right offering from an interior design perspective or a floor plan perspective or parking count perspective or all these little things that are going to be questioned in any sort of current market. And when we hit really well thought. And I can say this about most of our clients, they do that, but that those are the things that how Rennie as a company has changed given the current state of the market in terms of the preparation work that we've done. You know, in the hot market, you can come to market very, very quickly with not as much kind of storytelling assets. So people are looking to purchase with, you know, just some renderings, floor plans, pricing, and are happy to do so in a market that's a bit tougher and people are going to ask all the questions, which of course they should. We have the appropriate tools in our tool belt to let buyers know really what they're purchasing and feel comfortable with the purchase. Because in pre-sale, really, the challenge is the timeline to completion. Most people that are buying for themselves don't want to wait three years. So you really need to offset that time frame that they had in their mind with what is an incredible offering in terms of value and finish and quality and reputation and all the things that come along with it. You know, we certainly look at the clients that are asking us for help, like if they're coming to us to take on their project. Right now, given the state of things, we want to really vet that project to say, is it something that's viable? Like, are the economics behind the project doable? And we're very honest with some clients. You know, we don't necessarily think it can sell at a certain price point, or we think you've under pro forma your construction costs based on what we're seeing. And like, we really lean in to help to make sure this is a viable site. And we've always done that, but I certainly can speak from experience that I'm on projects now upwards of 2 to 3 years before it comes to market, where previously it was maybe 12 to 18 months. So a lot longer feasibility study to ensure it's going to be the right thing for the people that will be living there.
Interesting. And so that sounds like even more potential delays for when stuff is actually delivered then. You know, we were saying last year in 2024 that the saying was, I think, survive until 25 for the development community. And, yeah, you know, now here we are in 25 and it feels almost more uncertain than ever. What does this mean for most projects? Does this mean that we're going to see a lot of launches pushed into 2026? Does this mean fewer deliveries or fewer launches, I guess? Or what does this mean for presale in general in your mind?
So, I mean, interesting. Let's break it down to product type. Townhomes and wood frame, as an example, complete a lot quicker. There's a really much lower barrier to entry in terms of financing your project, meaning essentially there are usually lower unit counts, 80 to 140 homes, as opposed to a tower, which can be 500. You only generally need, depending on your relationship with the bank, 50 to 60% of that revenue sold, where a tower is creeping up towards 70% of your home sold, right, within 12 to 18 months, depending on the number of homes in the building. So when you look at towers in a time that there's not a lot transacting, you have to find a way to get to, let's call it 300 out of 400 homes sold in an 18-month period at a higher price because concrete's more expensive. Where a wood frame project, 120 homes, call it, you might only need to sell 60 homes or about 50% of the revenue in that 12-month period or 18-month period, again, depending on the number of homes. So a lower percentage, easier to get finance, less risk. So what I'm seeing is more developers that have multiple potential sites to come to market are pivoting to townhome or wood frame launches. And those always have been the bread and butter of Vancouver real estate. You know, towers are amazing, huge marketing budgets, flashy. But generally what we see, whether it be Tri-Cities, Burnaby New West, out towards the valley, what have you, you see wood frame product being what the end user and the buyers that are in the market now flock to because it's a little bit lower price. Again, it's completed quicker, lower deposits, all these benefits. And there's developers that have sites that, because of transit changes or the new, say, Langley, Surrey transit line, are able to build up to 15, 16 stories and are opting to just keep it at a six-story wood frame because it originally penciled at that. They have added density, but they're not adding the density because now they have a higher threshold for financing, more challenged sales environment. The percentage return on cost sometimes is only slightly more. And wood construction is creeping up in cost as well. So there's not a significant gap between the two. So they're looking at it as I can get this done. I can deliver homes. I know who my buyers are. I've been building wood frame for a long time. And it's less risky. And it's something that we need to move forward on because I can also charge less for the end product home. So I have more buyers that'll be interested in purchasing it. So you are seeing developers turn down certain densities in certain areas. So when I look at the future of pre-sale this year, is I do think people will pivot to, if they have, like I say, multiple sites, to looking at wood frame or townhome. concrete sites are certainly taking a pause. There's not a ton of concrete sites I'm aware of that don't have at least a little bit of cash flow to ease the pain, whether it's an existing strip mall or a rental building that's going to have rental replacement or what have you. So there's a little bit of reprieve there for those landowners, but they'll wait. They, you know, you're going to spend a few $1 million getting this marketing endeavor and presentation center and such ready to potentially not hit your financing criteria. And then by law, we have to stop marketing and sales. And then you got to go back to the drawing board, revamp, try to get it done right the next time the market cycle comes around. So they'll look at it and say, do I want to put, let's call it on the low end, like $1.5 million, $2 million towards marketing and presentation center to not get it? Or do I want to just hold that money, pay my land cost until I know the market's in a place that it'll support getting this project underway, right? So the economics of these projects are what's determining if they're going to launch or not. I know this city would love the prices to just drop so that they can get to 60%, but unfortunately, the way costs, government taxation, financing costs, and everything comes into play, it's not reasonable for them to do this for zero profit or no profit. And the profit is a sliver as it is of what it used to be. So builders aren't going to move forward and just build housing and pay their staff for free or for a loss. So we come to this stall, right, of what to do. And we're seeing a few more sites that are going into distress or being sold off at a bit of a loss to developers that have the ability to hold land and stuff. So again, it's just this movement in terms of who owns what, how new are you to the industry of development, how great are your systems, what's your cash flow like on the site, that's going to determine it. But concrete-wise, I think we're going to see a significant reduction in number of homes for sale. Wood frame and townhome, I think we'll just see a continued steady flow of wood frame and townhome product come to the market. Those are the buyers that are in the market now, so it makes the most sense.
And Jack, I'm just thinking about this. So you laid it out really well, I think, in terms of the number of factors that make wood frame more attractive right now from a building standpoint. The one thing we've been talking a lot about on this show is, of course, concrete takes 3, 4, 5 years, however long. It's always been attractive to investors as opposed to end users for that reason. Can you talk a little bit about the lack of investors and
sure,
what does it take to move back to a market where, you know, people are building 500 homes instead of 80 or 120? Is it just that investor coming back into the market, or is something else needed, or how have you guys been thinking about that, if at all?
It's a phenomenal question. It's multifaceted on a number of levels, I think. But let's look at a few things. Government policy stabilization, I think, is probably the largest when you look at things. You know, cost has pushed price up enough that a lot of kind of one-off rentals don't make sense. Right? Like a buyer will come in and buy a one-bedroom home to be a rental and expect to cover their mortgage, their strata fees, their insurance, their property taxes, all that. The cost of a home to deliver, not even just to have made a little bit of money on it if you're developing it, or if, say, the government gets into the private sector and starts developing it and sells it at cost or for a little profit as well. Let's say somebody buys it at cost or close to, which is not available at the moment, and is able to get $2,800 a month when their mortgage and all fees in are $3,000 a month. And they say, it doesn't make sense. You know, there's 200 bucks a month I don't want to be servicing into this home. It should, as an investment, cover itself. And you know, the way that I talk about that with our sales teams or people on the floor that aren't certain, and the way that I certainly look at individual investment is, as long as that rent payment I get from a tenant covers my mortgage interest, property taxes, strata fees, and all that, and if I have to subsidize, because let's go back to that example of $200 a month, but I'm paying off $400 a month in my principal, it's for savings, right? I'm doubling my money every month. I put 200 in, I get 400 off my principal because of all of that. And then as the market corrects or rental rates come back and grow, then I'll get back into a place of positive. Not everybody looks at it that way. I think that's one thing, is the one-off investors that look at, I just want everything covered, are gone because the financial structure doesn't make sense. And maybe there's an education period to come back to take a little bit out of your RSPs maybe and put it into real estate on a monthly basis or what need to. But there's a risk adverse feeling in the market amongst those, you know, one or two rental home people that aren't savvy, aren't running full performers, don't have a big portfolio of it, or aren't institutional rental owners. When you look at the more savvy investor that has maybe a portfolio or these institutional investors, you're really challenged with government policy. And I come back to that point. And examples are when the foreign purchaser ban or taxes came in, they didn't retroact anything. So if you were somebody that bought a home within the rule book of what was allowed a year into construction, they changed the rules on foreign policy and it applied to you, even though you bought under the existing rules. That's one. Now, a lot of people will say, don't talk about foreign. Okay, I'll give a local example. Airbnb rules. A lot of people bought, even projects that were zoned to allow resort living or Airbnb short-term rental, are not allowed to do that. And it's completed. And now you have a challenge renting it long-term or what have you. And a lot of folks out there will say, well, that's the risk they took. And that, sure, you know, everything's a risk and investment. I'm not saying that one way or another. I can see both sides of the argument. However, for investors, they just want to understand that if they purchase under a set of rules, that those rules are going to apply to their contract right up to the point that they complete on that home. Like, it's, why would you put money in when the government can change the rules and pull the carpet out from under you? So that is one of a very large number of different policies and perspectives that you could see that have spooked the investor. So like overall cost, policy changes. We have also seen a government that's moving towards negative population growth for the first time since we became a country. So students on visas, immigration, which has built this country, and other things. You know, you have fewer and fewer people that'll look to rent your homes and go that route. Now, you can look at areas like Surrey, which has a city center, which is building concrete, which also has wood frame product. And as a municipality, it's still growing by approximately 2,200 people per month. So like, there's healthy investment areas that if the government policy stabilization happened or people felt comfortable that what they're hearing out of our leaders are going to be sustained, I do believe that you'd see a number of investors come back. A very long-winded answer to your question. But again, so I think that paints the picture of how multifaceted this is, and depending on what level of investor. And you know, one final comment on it is people will hear this and say investors are what's bad or what's ruined real estate. I hear that a lot. But we have to remember that for the last number of decades, the investor, which could be a mother, father, or a same-sex couple, or an individual alone that has a lot of equity, just wanted to pick up a rental property, maybe for a family member, maybe for themselves. And they were the only people adding to the rental pool in Vancouver because there was no institutional rental construction or very, very minimal. So if we didn't have those people purchasing it, the buildings wouldn't have gotten built, because we wouldn't have hit that 70% sold threshold. We wouldn't have added any rental stock to the market. Our rent rates would be astronomically higher because there would have been new rental added. And our housing prices would have been astronomically higher because we wouldn't have had many of these projects that came to market get to that 70% threshold of sales. So investors, as a word, it's a dirty word, but they provided a ton of good on the landscape of the Vancouver housing. And I just want to make sure that that point comes across, that we shouldn't villainize people that were adding this rental and market housing stock.
So on that point, Jack, because that kind of leads into just a thought about this, they were the only ones putting up the deposits to get the financing, to get the condo towers built. They're no longer participating, for at least in not in the way they were. Is there the general sentiment right now, we have to wait for them to come back? Like, how do concrete towers get built without them? Or do they just not get built? And we kind of wait till, you know, David Eby seems to be pivoting a bit at this point. I'm certain that, you know, the dominoes will start falling the longer we go on this way without the capital being invested. But is there any other way that we actually get this housing built in your mind?
Yeah, and that comes back to looking at what we're building, right? How are we building housing for the people that want to build it in the moment? I think the challenge with that is because of the lengthy period of time it takes for us to get to approval process and then sell it and construct it, is if we help design a building in the moment, and let's say, you know, the investor is out, let's look towards more functional 2-bedrooms and 3-bedroom homes or one and then for people that work at home as opposed to studios. Like studios right now, I don't see selling very strong at all, as an example. So let's say we pivot off of the studio and we create a more robust home. The price is going to go up, but you have more buyers that'll pay for it because in the market right now, it's an end user buyer. But we design that building and in a year, it all comes back to a level of balance or health. Is that building now built for the current market because of that year delay before we get our permits? It's really challenging. We are seeing concrete buildings come to market. It's interesting, not as many. And I think what we'll see through 2026, 2027, 2028 is a real reduction in completions and therefore a reduction in new inventory coming to market. What the current concrete market has to deal with is all of the successful projects that are in 2021 are completing this year. So you have something like 2,500 developer-owned, unsold, brand new homes coming to market. So that competes on the resale. So if somebody does want new, they don't want resale, they have opportunity now. So those concrete towers will start when that cleans up, which I think 26, we'll see it a lot more starts than 25, 27. Again, Vancouver's cyclical market, lots of inventory, no inventory, lots of inventory, no inventory, which is very consistent. You know, you can almost project to be seeing in that 26, 27, 28 market. So it was probably a good time to come back in the market if you're an investor because you're pricing and you're getting some good credits and discounts or flexible deposit terms right now. But you know, we had a few towers that have been successful in this down market in Intercorp's Gardena up in Burquitlam. Did very, very well. We're seeing success in Surrey on Bridge City, which is really well priced and beautifully designed. You know, Inform Kitchens, which is the first time we've seen it in a tower in Surrey. And they made that adjustment to level up their offering to attract those buyers, right? As opposed to some other towers in that area where we're not using Italian cabinetry and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So these people that are pivoting, these developers that are making the right moves, you know, Anthem is a great one. Rennie doesn't work with them. I can't speak to their inner workings, but from the outside, I look at a company like Anthem, who does wonderful jobs, you know, really establishing the communities they're building and have a great sales program. You know, Elba and Liz and everybody that work over there are just incredible, intelligent people that are driving that. So as long as you're underpinned with, you know, people that have a general read on the market, you can get your concrete tower financed and built. That's really what it comes down to, is experience. Again, reputation, quality, all those fundamentals that should be in every home, in my opinion.
Hey, everyone. Pardon the interruption. We just want to take a quick minute to thank the following sponsors who make this show possible. This podcast is sponsored by Fenway by Caliber, bringing 209 new homes and 24,000 square feet of retail space to Willoughby Town Center.
And this retail component isn't just adding to the area, Adam. It's enhancing an already thriving community hub where neighbors connect over boutique shopping, great food, and everyday essentials. This is one of the final new construction opportunities to own in the heart of Langley's Willoughby Town Center.
And speaking of Langley, is it me or is Langley all you hear about these days? It's become such a powerhouse with over 7,000 businesses, the population set to double by 2040, and that SkyTrain extension arriving in 2029.
What's incredible about this location is that you're getting the best of everything. Your steps from the Langley Events Center, currently undergoing a massive $149 million expansion. The new Tennis Center and future Willoughby Community Center are right across the street. Plus, you've got the new Smith Athletic Park just down the road.
The location really is unbeatable, with 8 schools within walking distance and just minutes from Highway 1. And what I love is that this is a caliber project. They're Langley locals with decades of experience who really understand this community. They've partnered with Polyco Group to bring decades of development expertise to Fenway.
With Langley's population set to double and transit connectivity expanding, this is your chance to be part of BC's fastest growing community. Register at fenwayliving.com. That's FENWAY living.com.
Fenway, where small town heart meets urban sophistication.
We are also sponsored by Oakland Realty. This is our real estate brokerage, best brokerage in the city, hands down. If you are in the industry, a new agent, an aspiring agent, somebody just looking to make a change, new culture, new energy, new resources, head over to oakland.com/join, type in VRP 2020. That's oakland.com/join, type in VRP 2020. Not only do you get to meet Michael Morgan and the gang, the bigwigs over at Oakland, you get a huge incentive for first going to oakland.com/join, typing in VRP 2020.
So Jack, for some of our listeners that maybe are in the resale market, and we've been talking a lot about new construction, but what's the relationship between the presale market and the resale market?
That's a good question. And it's kind of flip-flopped over the years. You know, sometimes you'll see that the resale market is achieving a premium to presales, which is kind of the older stock when presales were first coming into the landscape of Vancouver. You would buy it because it was maybe a one-bedroom home, a little bit smaller square footage, but it was less expensive. You know, as pre-sale has been what's required to build new housing, now market housing, that is, because banks will need to see those sales to lend on construction. That's offset because now you've got these holding costs and you've got these, you know, government taxes and continue adjustment on those taxes, which can be up to 30% of the cost of a home, right? So now the pre-sale world is taxed, you know, dad pun, it's taxed with all of these challenges of delivering product in a cost-effective way. So pre-sale became a bit more of an investor play because you didn't have to pay the mortgage, the strata fee, the property tax for 3 years, right? So you could put a deposit down and see growth, you know, steady growth of the Vancouver market, 4-5% a year. At the end of that, you see that you've performed an increased rental rate and things work and whatnot. But now pre-sell is over resell because of all these costs. There's a lot of resell available inventory on the market and its end users are in there. So the resell market is really dominating right now over pre-sell. And what we're trying to figure out is, you know, how does it fit? Because don't get it twisted, like pre-sell is mandatory for the Vancouver market to continue to grow and thrive. And but we need to find ways to kind of connect the dots there. And so they play off each other. And if pre-sale really jumps, resale gets pulled up. And then when resale surpasses it, pre-sale will catch up. And there's this fluid relationship between the two. To pin it to like a specific price per foot, I can't, because it's got to be product dependent, location dependent, and all of that. But what I would say is there's benefits in the pre-sale world. I think, you know, the ability for a first-time home buyer that when they say the interest rates went up, they couldn't afford anything, and because now their monthly payment was out of their loan to value, could go to a pre-sale. They could get favorable deposit structures where they're putting down increments of 5%. Even if they're working and saving it as they go, they're able to build up to a 20% deposit before it's complete so they can avoid any CMHC fees or mortgage insurance fees. So there was savings for them there. There was the ability to save up. They got something brand new that wasn't restricted, you know, if they wanted to have a pet or whatever, like other stratas might have, even though we've gotten rid of a lot of those restrictions. Pre-sale provided a really valuable, viable option for people that wanted to buy. And at the moment, resell, you never know what lemons you're getting in the wall or if there's been permits pulled, or, you know, good realtors will go through that with you and make sure oil scans are done if you're looking at detached, or read the minutes if you're looking at strata. But with new, you're warrantied and there's some benefits. So I think those relationships will continue to float back and forth. And it really will be dependent on that each individual purchaser's situation at the time. But I don't think purchasers should discount researching pre-sale, because it'll give you a really good understanding, A, of what's happening in your neighborhood, even if you do buy a resale. But two, like, what are the options out there? And people think, you know, going into a sales center is really scary and I don't want these salespeople to hound me and this, that, and the other. But if you're in the market, get yourself educated on everything and then make the best option for you. And I can promise the sales teams are just there to help educate, not to try and put you into something you can't afford or you won't like. There's lots of stops there for you, whether it's rescission period, the ability to read the disclosure before you write the contract. That will be safety nets for you if you don't understand the pre-sale world. And it's worth really just taking a look to make sure that you've exhausted all options in terms of pre-sale, resale relativity.
Just thinking about we've kind of covered how a lot of the investors have left the building kind of for the moment. What are some of the bright spots in the market? And maybe kind of framed a different way. Like if you were talking to an investor who was considering making an investment in Vancouver real estate and the plan was to hold longer term, what would be some bright spots you might point to or what are your thoughts on that?
I mean, real estate should be a long-term investment. You know, anyone looking at it in the short term is very subject to risk. So what I do see and what I could foresee is in the moment, the bright spot is it's you as a buyer have the ability to shop for what you're looking for. If it's on resale, you know, put a good subject period in there for yourself. Make sure you're getting inspections done, that the home is appropriate for you. It's a great buy, all of that from a pre-sale perspective. Shop the different sales centers, understand what you're looking at. They're, like I say, very favorable terms right now. Like the cost is baseline to the cost of building it, but you can work out, you know, the odd credit or furniture credit or deposit relaxation or favorable deposit schedules on a site-by-site basis. And then when you look at when it's completing, let's call it 27, 28, there is a significant number of paused projects or canceled projects or projects that aren't coming to market that are going to create a real reduction in completion. So you, if you're purchasing in a project now that you know is very reputable, is going to be under construction soon or is already under construction, you're going to be closing into a period of time that there is a reduction in inventory. And foreseeably, that generally means an increase in price pressure, value add down the road, where you don't want to be buying in that market, because if that does come to play, you're going to be in competition with other folk. One of my favorite lines from a certain one I look up to quite a lot is, it's a cliff jumping phrase. It's to jump when the water's out, because by the time you're down there, the water's in. But if you jump when the water's in, it could be washing out and you're looking at rocks. You know, not to be traumatic about the phrase, but really, if the water's out right now and on the foreseeable future, it's an ocean and a market that continues to adjust. You're looking at timing it as best you can. And you're in a time right now that if you found the home for yourself and there's a good price, I see the bright spot in that ocean's coming back, that water's coming back. You're going to have a soft landing. And if you're looking to live in it, you'll be able to weather any storms. There's a whole new buyer bucket that's shown up in the last number of markets that kind of blends between investor and end user. And we call it the family investor here at Rennie. And I give myself as an example. So my son is 12 turning 13. I was working on a project last year that had, I thought, great fundamentals, great builder, great reputation. And I bought a one-bedroom home for my son, who was 12 at the time. It's going to be a four-year completion. I'll rent it for 4 years. And when he's 19 and we transfer ownership to him, he will have had 8-year-old pricing, which, you know, even in down markets, we see 3-4% growths and pricing and stuff. So he's foreseeably going to have some appreciated equity. He will have had a tenant in there for some time. So he can choose to keep it tenanted. He can sell it as long as he's buying other real estate with it, is my rule. Or he can live in it. And I think that family investor, that's one example of, is really prominent, actually more so in the market than we think. When we look at a lot of families that are buying property, they're sitting down and they're saying, is this something we want to have part of the family? We don't know if mom and dad are going to, or dad and dad, or mom and mom, or whomever. I just, for the record, want to be clear. I'm not trying to distinguish anyone. They want to retire into it, they can. If they want to rent it until somebody needs it, they can. If they want the kids to move into it or a family member, they can. But it's something that they're going to hold long term. And this family investor is this whole new carve out of folks that have grown equity over the decades in Vancouver, Fraser Valley, or what have you, and are buying condos now with that equity to have as a family asset. So that family investor bucket isn't gone the way that traditional investor we talk about is gone. It just means it's a different metric for purchasing, and it's that really long-term outlook of, is this viable for us?
Jack, I think we're all, at least in this conversation, optimistic about the long-term future. I'm just wondering how the next 6 to 18 months plays out in your mind and potentially where the opportunities are. A couple things we've been hearing about, I guess, especially with the tariffs, is it seems like interest rates potentially, you know, there's talk about interest rates coming down quicker than we thought. There's also talk of inflationary pressure. I think I just saw the Bank of Canada come out and say that, you know, inflation is going to be more challenging with the tariffs. There's the uncertainty in the market. There's all that product that is coming to completion and that is starting right around now from 2021. I guess I'm just wondering, like, how do you think this plays out? And, you know, Adam's joke about, you know, it's 11:20. So, you know, maybe there's an announcement after we hang up and everything changes. Like, assuming a relatively stable crappiness that we're in right now.
All things being equal in the crappiness, I think that the 6 to 18 months, whether it's reported on or not publicly, we are going to see a stabilization of these sales. I liken it back to what I said earlier about how November, December, January, we're seeing month over month increases until like a very profound commentary around tariffs came out. I do believe that that demand to have ownership exists and will continue. For me, when I look at it, I've always loved pre-sale because I like the timeline of completion and what have you. I think it provides a benefit. But if I was to look into the immediate, there are substantial homes that are built and completed or completing that are developer-owned, unsold homes. And that's because, say, that's in 2021, they got to 70-80% sold, got financed. And with the way that construction costs increase at such a velocity, a lot of developers held some homes back to be able to offset those construction costs with homes selling kind of towards completion, you know, opportunistically looking at maybe pricing adjusted upwards to cover those offset costs or those overruns on construction. You have a significant number of those homes coming to market across a variety of different communities, different developers. And, you know, people should note that because it's completed doesn't mean that there's an opportunity to come in and gouge. Now, there's still like a baseline cost that it costs to produce that home. But if you're looking at resale and it's in the relative price range of what you're looking at, take a look at these finished developer homes. They're brand new, never lived in. You get all the benefits of new construction, warranty, new buildings, great amenities usually built into this, you know, relative to maybe you're looking at a 15 or 20-year-old building that wasn't designed to the same standards that we're seeing right now in terms of offering lifestyle amenity and all that. So you have these homes that now very much compete with the resale market that have the advantages of a new home. And I think that that's a real bright spot as people should explore Pier West and New Westminster by Boza Development. So not Boza, you know, kind of preeminent figure of development here in Vancouver, has built these homes on the water. They are absolutely beautifully finished. They have amazing views and they're move-in ready. Like, you could pick one up if you're in the resale market, move in and live in a brand new finished home, that as opposed to buying something that's been kind of used and abused over the number of years in resale. Again, there's underlying construction baselines that will set the cost. But when you look at those, they compete relative to resale. And you can get an incredible high floor, beautifully finished, Boza-built home with water views on SkyTrain, grocery store nearby, like all of those amenities. These are bright spots to me. And I think as long as realtors out there are educated, which a lot are, and which is great, on kind of what's available to them, because not all of those homes are on, say, MLS, or buyers become more aware of where these homes are, that is a substantial opportunity. Back when Rennie was still in its infancy, I would say, and before it really has become the data back kind of strong leader in terms of sales and marketing, we took on a receivership from the city of the Olympic Village. And it was hundreds and hundreds of finished homes that were developer owned that people could go in and buy brand new. And I think anyone that bought at the Village in that time has seen substantial increase in value. You know, it was the opportunity to buy into a new community where generally pre-sales are 100% sold out. So unless you bought 3-4 years before, you didn't have a chance at new inventory, and you saw this community come to life. And I think, you know, it's not all concentrated in one area now, but this is the next coming of that. When I see it, I see this opportunity to move into what's going to be a flourishing community that's completed and moving ready. This, and I'm going to keep pounding this drum, like this is a fantastic opportunity for people in the market if they're really looking into it to really get a feel for what's available to them in terms of developer-owned, still finished new inventory. That's something that we don't see very often, and it's not going to be here for a while, maybe a year or so to really work through it. But after it's gone, it's likely going to be gone again for a number of years. So grab that opportunity.
Jack, we just had a Google review from a longtime listener, Sarah M. And she said, love this podcast and have been listening for several years. Request, curious with reluctance to talk about why buyers continue to sit on the sidelines. Prices are too high.
For sure. Fair.
What, when I think about like people on the sidelines right now and why they're not purchasing, like, do you think prices is the driving factor there? Or do you think, like, what would you tell Sarah? Because there's a lot of, you know, gunpowder in this city, right? Is that what's preventing people from moving forward? Is it prices?
Well, I'll shoot from the hip on this one because I think it's a super valid question and I don't think we should shy away from the conversation at all. And I'll say this is coming from me personally, not from Rennie, not from Intel, this is just my read on the market. I listened to Bo Jarvis, who's president of West Group. And he's a fantastic guy, very well educated on all things housing. And he was on a panel conversation a number of weeks ago. And he framed it as it's not an affordability issue, it's a cost of delivery issue. And I'm paraphrasing, sorry, Bo. Where if he got land for free and took zero profit in Vancouver, a 2-bedroom would cost approximately $1 million. Because that's the cost of constructing it. Not the land, no profit, just sheer cost. So what's affordability? How do you reduce pricing? Government's not necessarily bringing in subsidies or what have you. And they have to have income to run the province. So again, I'll be nice and I'll say like, hey, if we don't pay CACs on housing or these 30% taxes, essentially, you know, upwards of 30% on new housing, that general revenue's got to come from somewhere or those community contributions. So that might just be a property tax increase or what have you. That's just simply the cost of living and running a province and building housing and doing all of these things. So I really feel for that comment because it's super challenging. You know, and I work at a high level with housing, but like, don't get it twisted. When I wanted to get into real estate in Vancouver for myself, I bought a townhome in Kamloops and rode that and rented it for some time and built equity there, then moved it down to Vancouver and bought a very old, small 400 square foot one bedroom, did some elbow grease to get it worked up before I could buy a newer one bedroom and then eventually kind of work my way through the property ladder. I think it depends on your expectations in terms of what you're looking for. Are you looking to get into the market immediately into a 3-bedroom townhome? Are you immediately looking to get into just anything? I feel for the challenges there. And affordability will only come into play when we really take a look at that cost. Or maybe a very smart guy, development guy, saw a post on LinkedIn, a possibility of moving the government taxes off of the front end of a project to the back where they can be mortgaged. And then we can reduce the cost of the home. But then the taxes on the back end that go to community contributions become a mortgageable tax as opposed to a upfront cost that is financing requirements go into the cost of the home. So it compounds and you're paying essentially value on value. I'm a bit tangential right now because it's such a broad question, but until we address the cost of construction, until we get more skilled labor into the area, because we're 20 to 25% under the number of skilled workers we need to build these things. So if you are in construction, you can charge a bit more and therefore add to the cost and what have you. So we address the number of laborers, taxation, cost of running a province, and all of that it's just not going to happen that we'll see prices reduce at a drastic rate unless somebody's sitting on very historic land cost and is able to pass that savings on to the buyer, which we are seeing some of right now. So those like little moments of a reduced cost are happening, but it's not at a huge scale.
Jack, maybe as a final question for you, and I think this is particularly well suited for you in your role at Rennie. Is there room for significant appreciation in real estate in your mind? And more specifically, location and property type, where are you most excited about? What types of properties? And maybe thinking kind of 3 to 5 years.
Fair question. I think anywhere that there's a lack of construction or an unwillingness to approve property or an inability to approve property in a timely fashion provides opportunity. I look at North Vancouver and I'm a North Van resident. I think North Van consistently has been kind of underbuilt, which has continued to put upward pressure on pricing. I think when you look at New Port Moody, New Westminster, there's communities that haven't grown to the same degree that you've seen Burnaby or even Surrey City Center or areas of East Vancouver. Do I think there's appreciation possibility? Yes. I mean, everything in the world is getting more expensive. It's a challenge, but that includes cost to build these things, the cost of borrowing, the cost of land. That's going to push up what we have to charge, or else new housing doesn't get built. New housing doesn't get built. We have a reduction in inventory and the basic economics of it. Say we reduce our supply and demand will push pricing. We've seen year over year growth in the double digits in some years, like 2021 coming out of COVID, and back in 2017, 18, I think it was, or could be misquoting, maybe 16. We saw huge growth, and that's when we've gone to a very little amount of inventory, and there's a lot of people moving to the city, and that just pushes pricing up. We're in a moment right now that there's not that pressure on pricing, but that's decade over decade over decade has shown that those are the times that Vancouver increases the most coming out of these. We're at a very expensive moment in time for Vancouver. Now, those were moments when homes were 500 a foot, 600 a foot, 700 a foot. Now, like, you can't really get in concrete anywhere under 1100 bucks a foot, or else it doesn't make sense financially. Wood frame, you're over 1000 a foot now. It's very expensive. There's no two ways about it. So we might not see that same double digit velocity, but we've seen consistent growth in real estate. Let me pin it between 4 and 5% overall markets, kind of up markets, down markets, and what have you, over time. And that's going to continue. And that's a really healthy growth. So yes, there is going to be continued, I will put my stamp on it, continued equity growth and value growth in Vancouver real estate. And that's the whole GVRD. Areas that I'm excited about are the more tertiary areas of Langley, Tawasin, sub areas even of East Vancouver, Burnaby in the Edmonds area or the Lougheed area. Continued growth in Brentwood is happening as more name brand retailers and other things are coming to the area. Metrotown continues to grow. Coquitlam, and you look at what happened in West Coquitlam or Coquitlam on Transit, and it's really grown significantly. And you've got that opportunity in Port Moody and Coquitlam Center area now where you haven't seen significant density realized, but that density is coming. It's on transit lines. There's land owned by developers. It's going to come. And I look at, in the moment, again, look at standing finished developer inventory, or if you're looking for a long game purchase of a pre-sale, look in areas that have substantial master plans and you want to be the first in. Even in Vancouver proper, Grosvenor's got Mayfair West, which is going to be a multi-tower project of more significant price because of where it's located, the brand and the quality and such. But you want to be in those first couple of towers because as that community grows, there's growth in retail experience, there's growth in population, and therefore it pushes growth in price. Really look at right now in the moment, tertiary markets. Let me pick three: New Westminster, North Vancouver, and then I'll blank kind of Surrey Langley. That doesn't mean that other areas aren't strong for that long-term growth, but those would be three that if I had money to put into housing, I would put it into housing right now.
Well, maybe we'll leave it there. But Jack, we do have this segment called the Five Wire, Five Lighthearted Questions that we end every show with. Can you stick around for that?
Yep, I got you.
The Five Wire is brought to you by Atlin at Clayton Crest, a master plan community in the West Clayton area built by Zentera Developments.
Zentera is an absolute force, Adam. They've been recognized as Multifamily Home Builder of the Year for 10 years in a row and just won again at the Georgies for 2025 Multifamily Home Builder of the Year.
What's really exciting about Atlin is the West Clayton location. You're within walking distance to the future SkyTrain station, giving you that perfect balance of city access while living in a peaceful, family-friendly community in the Fraser Valley.
And if you have kids or are planning to start a family, there's an on-site daycare where residents get first access. This kind of thoughtful planning is why Zentera's projects stand out in the market.
The amenities at Atlin are incredible too, Matt. A rooftop patio with stunning views, fitness center, co-working space, and lounge areas for events. The outdoor space is extensive with two fitness areas, three children's play areas, and multiple spots to relax.
With major investments happening in the SkyTrain and the 72nd Avenue extension, West Clayton is set for explosive growth. This is genuinely one of those opportunities to invest in a community before values skyrocket.
And that's really the key here. This isn't just about finding a beautiful place to live. It's about making a smart investment in your future as the whole area continues to develop.
Pre-sales for Atlin will begin soon. Register today at atlincondos.ca. That's atlincondos.ca.
Perfect. Okay, so question number one, what is one book that you've read recently that you would recommend to listeners?
Oh, geez, you're putting me right on the spot, aren't you? It's one that I've read a number of times, and I think, you know, it speaks to community within a company. And it's Five Dysfunctions of Team by Patrick Lencioni. Like, a lot of people in real estate development have read it. It's about a woman that took over a tech company having come from agriculture and how she was looked at, oh, you don't know tech. What are you doing here? How are you going to help drive this company forward? And it wasn't about the knowledge. It was about the leadership and how to galvanize your team through strong leadership, not necessarily through specific skill or knowledge. It's a wonderful, easy read, and it really kind of resets your brain on how to engage with people and the context of how to talk to people. And I think that's important right now.
And sorry, Jack, I missed the title.
Five Dysfunctions of Team. It's by Patrick Lencioni.
Fantastic. Second question for you. In the last few years, what new belief, behavior, or habit has most improved your life?
Oh my gosh. Well, anyone that knows me knows that I'm a huge advocate for mental health. Having had challenges in the past, having known friends that have been challenged with it, and having lost some incredible people even in our industry. So really focusing on mental health, work balance. It's hard to say that sometimes because we all have pressures. But what I've kind of adopted is a mentality of really understanding where other people are coming from. The context of how they engage with me, because that's all I can control, right? I can't control anything outside of my control. And it goes back to a philosophy of that there's like 1,000 of you. So Adam, there's 1,000 Adam Scalinas in the world. Every single person that's met you knows a different Adam Scalina based on how they were feeling in the moment they met you, the interaction they had with you. Have they dated someone named Adam and they didn't like it, or they did like it? You know, did you order your coffee at Starbucks in a friendly or a rude way? Each person you've ever met knows a different version of you. And only you know what your intent was, right? So you might have these interactions. Maybe, oh, that person was a real jerk to me. Well, you don't know kind of what Adam Scalina they received. So what I go into now, whether it's in a meeting or in a personal interaction, is ask questions like, what's the context of why are you reacting in that way? What was the trigger? What happened? So that I can know what version of Jack Bernard I'm speaking to, basically. So really trying to unfold the situation that other person's in so that I can act accordingly, because I can only control how I act. And then that helps level the playing field on a mental health perspective.
That's a great one.
Yeah. Number three.
This question always feels a little like, well,
I'm ready for it.
What have you been binge watching lately, or a favorite movie recommendation?
All of the shows, Severance, White Lotus. When I watch a heavy show, like I just watched the finale of White Lotus last night. No spoilers. It's all good. But I have to decompress with like a lighthearted show. I love Love is Blind. I will admit that I'm a reality show junkie. and Maddie, who's my fiance, and I watched Summer House together. The struggles of Carl and Lindsay. If you don't know the show, you won't get it, but it's awesome. Amanda needs to leave Kyle. It's time. It's time. But yeah. I'll watch a heavy show and then I'll watch a really light show and then I'll go to sleep.
I would have never pegged you as a Love is Blind fan, but...
if you haven't watched it, you're missing out. It is fantastic TV.
Is that the one? I'm just trying to think. I've seen it.
You meet each other in a pod. You don't get to see each other.
Oh, that's the one.
You only get to talk, okay. And then you have to get married. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's awesome. It actually feels like dating life. Like when I was... after, my ex and I split... Very amicably, wonderful mother. And I did start dating a few years after that before I met my current fiance. It felt like a Love is Blind always because the apps, you don't see somebody, you're just talking to a person. So it's basically actually made a more real version of dating apps, which I think is why I love it so much because there's too much drama out in the world of dating.
Oh, that's the best.
I thought it was the one where they popped the balloons.
Oh, yeah, pop the balloon. That's... Jack, if you haven't seen that,
I have not seen that.
That's a watch something heavy and then follow it with pop the balloon and you'll what a night.
I will check it out.
Oh, next question. Favorite band or music you're enjoying lately?
Sentimentally, I really love Dermot Kennedy. Good Irish singer.
I think you're the second person to bring him up on the show, actually.
You guys got to get on it. He's great. I love all music. I think most of my playlist, my Spotify recap was all indicative of having a 10-year-old daughter, 9-10-year-old daughter. So a lot of Taylor Swift, top 5% Taylor Swift listener because of my daughter. Olivia Rodrigo, Sabrina Carpenter, Chapel Roan. It's just like pop, pop, pop. But when it's myself, I listen more to like comedy. I love comedy. So I'll put like Netflix as a joke on Sirius when I'm driving to just kind of decompress and have a laugh. Or Dermot is great. Yeah, all of that.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. Last but not least, something you've purchased for under $1,500 that's had a positive impact on your life in the last few years.
I mean, so much of my life is my kids. So I could say any number of sporting equipment or events or what have you. You know, my daughter's turning 10 this year, so she gets one of these trips. But 3 years ago, my son was turning 10. And so for his birthday, he's a LeBron James fan. I took him on. It was the first time him and I did a solo trip together where sister wasn't there or other people. And we went down to Portland and watched a Lakers game. And the tickets, I spent up on the tickets, but they were under $1,500. And he actually caught LeBron's towel and it got thrown into the crowd. And just like a bonding moment of it, like I'll spend money on experience 10 times out of 10. And it was hilarious because at one point he'd ate so much popcorn. We got back to the hotel and he was throwing up. And then he looked at from the toilet at me and he goes, "This is the best." And I just remembered my university days. And I'm like, "You're too young for that." He was throwing up because of popcorn, not beer. But that's a memory I'll always have. And I got to bond more with my son and him and I are closer than ever. That was the start of it because after I separated, it was tough kind of reconnecting with the kids for a variety of reasons. And those moments that you spend with them and now we just have the best relationship and that was the catalyst for sure.
A great spot to leave it for today, but thanks so much, Jack, for taking the time. If anyone wants to learn more about what you're up to or Rennie, what's the best way they can follow along?
I'm not a big social guy. I'm on LinkedIn, Jack Bernard. My Instagram is mostly my kids, so you'll probably be bored of it. You can always reach out. My email is jbernard@rennie.com, and I put that out there. I don't mind. Like, I love talking real estate. I love meeting new people. I think everyone's got interesting perspectives. So if you're curious, you want to reach out, email me is best. My phone, I don't always answer numbers I don't know, although I try to. So email is probably best, jbernard@rennie.com. And yeah, if you're curious, reach out. And I really appreciate you guys having me on. This was a lot of fun. I really think you guys do a great job.
Oh, thanks so much, Jack. And we appreciate you taking the time. That was a great conversation.
So there you have it, folks. Our discussion with Jack Bernard, VP Client Services over at Rennie.
That was great. Loved having Jack on the program. And I think we invited him on. It's been a few months, so I've kind of been looking forward to this episode. I think we invited him on around Christmas. So yeah, it's good to finally get him on. And it was a great analysis finally as expected. Some great takeaways. The thing about the building the wood frame, even though you have like more density, but it's just if the numbers pencil and you can kind of get in, get out in you know 2 years and at a more maybe appealing price point or appetizing price point, then you know certain developers are opting to do that, which is you know that's a little surprising.
You don't hear very often about builders not building to the capacity in terms of FSR. The interesting thing there is, and we didn't really talk about it too much, but obviously I think it's a couple of policies coming home to roost. One is the provincial government mandating more density, and especially around SkyTrain lines and SkyTrain stations, while at the same time creating a situation in which many of the people that traditionally finance pre-sales by actually buying the units, that is investors, making it much less attractive for them to participate. So it's interesting to think that the NDP is kind of moving back towards welcoming investors into the market, because I feel like this is a clear sign that those two policies are conflicting and we're not getting what we need built.
Yeah. So the question is, how many times can you smack an investor and will they still come back? And to TBD.
Well, yeah. And the other thing that I really liked, and this has been said a couple times on the show, but I think, you know, now it's becoming abundantly clear. All of the construction that was originally launched in 2021 that is now completing, a lot of that inventory, or not a lot, but there's a lot of the completions, those units are still held by developers who are looking to sell those units. Jack suggested that the opportunity for the next 12 to 18 months will be that inventory where developers are looking to get out of projects and get those properties sold. And that's an interesting part of the market to be watching. And that's what he likened to Olympic Village 2010, where people made out like bandits. And it will be interesting to see who takes advantage of the opportunities in 2025, 2026.
It will be for sure. Matt, what else do we have before we cut for the day?
What else do we have? We have VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. This is our website where all things real estate related live. Head over to VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com for things like the LiveWire. This is our weekly mailer where we're sending out VIP access to pre-sales, deal of the month. We have stats, different types of stats, the real estate board stats, but also sales ratios where you can dig into neighborhoods, price bands, really get granular. We also have, of course, tried and true, Adam, private client services.
Yeah, Matt. And if you are not using PCS, you are standing still while the rest of us power walk by. You get sold prices, days on market. You basically get realtor level information for free. It's available at your fingertips over at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. Just click buy with us and you can set up the best listings management software, your own private account with a favorites folder. You got everything there. It's your own dashboard to monitor Vancouver real estate. And it's a free service, again, over at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. Sign up today. And Matt, if anyone wants to talk about that or anything else, how can they get in touch with you?
They can get in touch with me at any time, 778-847-2854 or matt@VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
Or you can try me at 778-866-4574 or adam@VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
And of course, as always, we have that nonpartisan Kokomo line, info@VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
Well, have a great week and we'll be back next week with another great episode. I think we have Kyle Green delving into mortgage tricks next week.
Mortgage renewals. A lot of people are renewing in 2025 and early 2026. And it's an interesting moment to be thinking about mortgages with everything going on. So we brought Kyle back on the show and it is a conversation that does not disappoint. So stick around for that next week and have a great week.
Take care.
2000 Spaces for Radio. Subscribe today.